On the Record.
On News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. A community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.
They're joining students to go through today's papers and some of the issues making the news by Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and a columnist with the Business Post, and by Gabia Getafiskaita, who's the political correspondent at the Irish Independent. Dan, I know you fall into the broad category of people who think that the media spends too much time talking about COVID.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe
I'll
pick your brain about that more in a minute. But Gabia, first, just your reaction to what we've heard there, because if you take what Angelique Coetzee has told us at face value there, it seems that the rest of the world has gotten itself worked up into a frenzy about something which may not justify it.
Yeah, and I think especially that the last point of that interview is, you know, you're saying, well, do you think that this is due to vaccine inequality? And her saying, absolutely, yes, it's no mystery that this variant has emerged. And I think that this is really what living with COVID is going to look like until you have a situation where literally the entire world is fully vaccinated at all times. You're going to see things like variants emerge, and I think that's the reality. This isn't new. We've been here before with variants emerging, and I think certainly I made the fatal mistake this week of going around and breaking the one unwritten rule of journalism, which is don't complain that it's quiet when it's quiet. And that's what I did.
That came back to bite you, didn't it?
Yeah, that came back to bite me Thursday evening. I was working late and I went into a pub for a drink, and I came out and the world had completely changed, because as we knew, Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly came out and said that he's very worried about this new variant. And then we had that NPHET advice as well. They'd broken overnight. And Friday evening, I was working late writing about travel restrictions. So look,
I sort of feel like Toy Show Day is cursed, because the Toy Show Day last year was when they decided to lift the level 5, but then there was a row with NPHET about whether they should have allowed hospitality or household visits and all of that again. And now today, again, this time around, the Toy Show completely overshadowed by this new variant as well.
Well, it's interesting that we're kind of in a very similar place as we were last year. I think last year things were a lot easier because nobody was vaccinated. So when the numbers were up and when the virus was spreading, it was kind of, you know, we have to lock down the country, have to put in restrictions. But now we have so many people that are vaccinated, the virus is still on a rampage, and now we have this new variant that has thrown everything into disarray. You know, I suppose, what does that mean for restrictions? I think it's interesting to see the Mail on Sunday reporting today that Dr. Tony Holland, who's the chief medical officer, he's told an NPHET meeting that the country may lose control of COVID if new restrictions are not imposed in the coming week, and that NPHET will come back this week with a 3-month plan of dealing with COVID. I think that's quite a welcome development, because that's what we have been asking for, is a plan. What do we do if things don't go according to plan? And this variant is, of course, throwing all of our plans into disarray. But I think there's no need to panic just yet. I did have a think about it, because I was certainly on Friday and Thursday evening, I was spooked, and the Omicron, it sounds so ominous, and it's really not the news that you want to be hearing. But I think that maybe, you know, obviously we have the vaccine, we have the antivirals, maybe we shouldn't get into too much of a tiffy just yet. We did see, in fairness to the government, they did move very quickly to put in place travel restrictions. I suppose now the big question is are those restrictions going to be enough?
Or indeed, are they justified in the first place? Dan, before I invite you to offer your thoughts about whether we're all getting our knickers in a twist over nothing much, just what do you make of the way in which different governments have moved in the last 48 hours and whether all of that is proportionate?
Well, proportionate is the key question, Gavin. You know, given there's uncertainty, then I think, you know, there's a case to restrict travel a bit and until we have a better idea from the medics exactly how this differs from previous versions.
So you think that we've, broadly speaking, we've sort of hit the happy medium in the last couple of days?
In terms of travel restrictions, I think there is a case, proportionate case, given the uncertainties.
Owen O'Malley, a regular on this programme, is writing today in the Sunday Independent that the media has gotten itself way too worked up, not just about Omicron, but rather about COVID in general, that there is too much obsessing about it, that it's too dominant a theme on programmes, I dare say, possibly like this one. You have some sympathy for that outlook.
Gavin, I've been writing about this since September before last, and I don't blame the media. Media is a reflection of society. You know, in the summer of 2020, foreign diplomats started coming to me and saying, what's going on? Why is the national conversation in Ireland so obsessive? All my friends, foreign friends here, all my Irish friends abroad pay attention to things here. Countries I've visited since the pandemic. You know, this is a really bad thing. We all wish it hadn't happened. But it's really curious how traumatized we've been in Ireland about it. It's not just the media. I think the media reflects society.
So in other countries, they've just kind of moved on, or it's just not as much occupying their thoughts?
Exactly. I'm not saying moved on. We can't, because it's still here. Everyone is conscious of it. But, you know, it's just not everything. You know, as Mike Ryan of the World Health Organization said in the past few days, the sky is not falling in. This is a tragedy. I know people who've died from COVID. It is awful. And it's awful that we're going to have to live with it, but we will. And we can't stop. We can't talk about it all the time at the expense of the huge number of other important issues and holding government to account that needs to be done.
And we'll talk about some of those other issues, including the cost of living and the prospect of a united Ireland as well, raised by that opinion poll. And we'll get to them in a couple of minutes' time. But I suppose one of the arguments about why Ireland might be so obsessed with it is because we seem to be maybe more on the precipice of having to introduce draconian measures, the likes of a full lockdown or some other major curbs on how we live our lives, because of the undersized health service. So it means that because of the scheme of public administration we have, because of the way that society's been set up, because of how health has been funded, that COVID matters more to how we're going to live our lives.
I don't buy that. We have one of the highest per capita spendings on health in the world.
But we have one of the lowest rates of intensive care beds.
In January, the system didn't get overwhelmed. There were twice as many people in intensive care with COVID, four times more in hospital.
It did get overwhelmed, though. If you talk to anyone who was on the front line, they would say that was a system that was overwhelmed.
It was absolutely terrible, and nobody wants to go back there. And thankfully, now we have vaccines. But the argument that in some way Ireland's health service is inferior to every other country in Europe, even much poorer countries, that's just nonsense. And we know that from before the COVID ever came. People walked around talking about Ireland having a third world world health service.
No,
all the metrics don't stack.
But I'm not saying third
world,
but in terms of the capacity of our system, we're not getting as much bang for our buck as other countries. But
that's again one of those things that we really do need to debate, because that does seem clear. We've had the highest increase in health expenditure over the past 20 years, and yet there are still many problems. Now, that's not to say that, you know, every country you go to, you'll hear health stories. Health is a big issue in many countries, in even outside COVID times. It's always an issue. Whether look at Britain, NHS always talking about waiting lists and problems in the winter. That's just the nature of things. You know, you can never spend too much on health.
Gabby, I don't know how much you're in contact with friends and family back in Lithuania, but do you share Dan's assessment that Ireland is more obsessed with this, or that it's occupying Irish minds more than it would in other countries?
I think certainly the Irish people are, you know, in fairness, and I think if you look at the high rates of vaccine uptake, you know, they don't want restrictions and they don't want to be in lockdown, and they've been told by the government, if you take this vaccine, if you get fully vaccinated, if you, you know, stick by the restrictions, this is going to be our way out. And they've done that. And if you look at Eastern Europe, and, you know, there has been CSO polling done here saying that vaccine uptake in, I suppose, I'm from Lithuania originally, and I suppose Eastern European communities in Ireland is lower than that in the Irish communities. And if you look at Eastern Europe in general, vaccine uptake is also lower. You know, that kind of stems from things like not trusting the government and things like that. But in fairness, the Irish people, you know, they've been told, take the vaccine. This is our way out of lockdowns. Mm. This is how you're going to avoid restrictions. And we've done that. But that's not been enough, as we can very clearly see now. We've got 94% uptake, but that now has not been sufficient.
Does that then contribute to why we might be talking about it more and more concerned and more obsessed with it than other countries? Because we've done everything we were told and it hasn't turned out to be the silver bullets it might have been perceived as?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the government, you know, the vaccine, of course, it's brilliant and we know that, and it helps prevent against, you know, death and serious illness, but it has not been the one all end all as we were promised, let's be frank about it. It's not enough to curb the spread of the virus completely and to eliminate it. And also, you know, it raises that question of, again, vaccine equity. And this is how we have this new variant now, is because the rest of the world is not being vaccinated at the same rate. You know, I think people pin their hopes up against it a little bit too much. And, you know, obviously the best thing that you can still do is to get vaccinated.
First person to observe this about Ireland was a foreigner who comes from a European country that was devastated by the Second World War. And that person put forward the idea that maybe because Ireland hasn't had a huge national trauma within living memory, that is what's caused us. And my wife's Brazilian, and when this all started, you know, she said, look, you know, we have yellow fever, we have, you know, much higher crime rates, much higher deaths on the road, we have all sorts of tropical diseases and insects.
A higher level of daily strife.
Of daily risk. And you know, maybe we in Ireland, and I also noticed between the difference between coverage in Northern Ireland and here. Again, you know, BBC Northern Ireland, the British, the Northern papers don't cover it as much as we do down here. And obviously the North has had a major trauma within living memory.
Yeah.
And maybe that explains it. Again, these are just theories.
And it's a worthwhile theory as well. And I'm going to draw a line under COVID for now as well, because I know you'd both like to talk about plenty of other things. But just on that, when I heard that argument be put forward, and I've a lot of sympathy for that argument, but people would say, would what happened to this country between 2008 and 2011 not count as something of a, obviously not on the same scale as a war, but it's a pretty major national trauma in living memory?
Yeah, great. Well, it was, but I don't think it's on the scale of people dying like the Second World War.
11:29 on the record. Gavin Riley with you until 1 o'clock this Sunday lunchtime on News Talk. 53106 for your texts. On the record NT is the hashtag on Twitter. Still joined in studio by Dan O'Brien and Gabby Agatafitz-Keita. Looking at a major poll today in the Business Post, not the usual poll about political parties and the support of them, although, as I said in the introduction, it won't surprise you to learn that Sinn Féin remain the most popular party, still at 33% on the polls. Fine Gael down 3 points from the last one, now standing at 22. Fianna Fáil up 3 points to 15. Social Democrats, Labour, the Greens all about 4 or 5% and the rest, that's where they usually are. But they've done a more interesting poll inside, which gets a two-page spread on pages 14 and 15 of the paper today about attitudes towards a united Ireland. And it probably wouldn't surprise many of the listeners today to learn that if there was to be a referendum today, 60% of people say they'd vote in favour of a united Ireland. Only 25% right now say that they would vote against it. 62% of people say that they should start planning for a united Ireland as soon as possible. But when you dig a little bit deeper to see what sort of compromises people might be willing to make for a united Ireland, might it mean the adoption of a new flag or a new anthem? Might it mean giving unionists a certain number of guaranteed positions in a new All-Ireland cabinet? There isn't quite as much support. And Dan O'Brien, I want to come to you first of all. First of all, your reflections on the findings and whether you think people have really factored through all the consequences of what a meeting of two states might actually mean.
I don't think people have. As Michael Brennan, the political editor of the Business Post, says, the challenges are immense and far more complex than those posed by Brexit. Now, we all know that Brexit has been like unscrambling a million eggs, and it goes on and on and on. So bringing two countries and two nations, because we have two nations on this. We have the nation of which people around this table are part of, and then those who feel British. Mm. So bringing two nations into one state involves a new constitution, a million, 10 million things. Mm. So I think people understandably are getting on with their lives. It's not going to happen tomorrow. So people haven't thought it through. But I think, you know, this poll shows that when you start asking questions about issues around, for example, taxes, you know, just over half of Sinn Féin supporters would support United Ireland if it involved taxes, which is that's quite a finding in this, amongst many interesting findings. So I certainly would recommend, urge people, not just because I write for the paper, to buy the Business Post.
You would say that. I'll get you to pull the microphone slightly closer to your mouth, Dan, if that's okay.
Sure.
Gabby, your thoughts on all of this, because again, I wonder, I don't know whether people should see a united Ireland as being a total marriage of equals. I mean, as Dan says, there'd be two nations involved, but one would be much more popular than the other. And I suppose a lot of people would think, well, it might be a unity of the Republic and the North, but if most people identify as Irish, then why do we need to change a flag or an anthem?
Yeah, there's a, you know, we're seeing talk about United Ireland, obviously, because due to the, in part to the surge in Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald saying, you know, she sees a poll, she sees United Ireland in the next 10 years. That's an incredibly short space of time when you look at the issues posed by, you know, even in that poll, you know, issues around, like things that you would maybe see as a marginal issue, like the flag, for example, like the anthem. Like when you get into the nooks and crannies of it, those things are going to be just quite small moving parts and essentially a very big jigsaw, which is, you know, how will the health system work? How would, you know, how would we pay for it? How would it all combine?
How is it literally run? Do you still have Leinster House? Do you still have Stormont?
Exactly. Are you going to have a cross-country cabinet? Like, how is it actually all going to work? And those issues, like the tricolour, like the anthem, they're going to be quite minor issues in a scale. I think it's interesting that, you know, and again, not to bring up COVID, but, you know, if it wasn't for the pandemic...
I told you I wasn't going to bring it up. It would have to be one of you guys to do it.
If it wasn't for the pandemic, we would be focusing a lot more on issues such as United Ireland and perhaps housing as well. But, you know, I think it's interesting because if we are, as many are predicting, we're going to have a Sinn Féin government next time around, I think it's inevitable that we're going to be doing a lot more talking about a united Ireland.
45% said that they would be willing to support the continuation of the power sharing Northern Assembly in Belfast alongside the Dáil in Dublin in a united Ireland, which maybe begs some questions, Dan, as to what exactly they think a united Ireland would be if there was still a separate government for the North.
The Good Friday Agreement wouldn't disappear. You know, there would have to be changes. You know, united Ireland doesn't automatically mean Good Friday Agreement disappears. Mm. So there's the issue of then what role, because the government now, the government in the South and the Republic has a role in Northern Ireland, would London have some sort of role
yeah.
in the in the in in one part of the United
Nations. Some advisory role in the running of Ireland.
Absolutely. Yeah. So many questions.
So for people who don't maybe fully understand the nuances of all of that. So is it the case right now that because Northern Ireland under British rule is required to give certain consideration to the nationalist minority identity, that the same applies in the other hand, that if there was to be United Ireland, that the Dublin or All-Ireland government has to have some special consideration for the unionist minority?
I think these are exactly the sort of things that would have to get teased out, and they would have to get teased out over a long period of time, and it would be very difficult. And also, you know, we have to say that, you know, there is a risk that some people in Northern Ireland, particularly in the loyalist tradition, may respond very badly. So there are security risks around all of this. So we need to tread very, very carefully around this whole area and talk it through. And one thing I'd like to see, and I've suggested this, to people who feel very strongly about it, why not draft a constitution for a 32-county state? So you have all the detail in there, and people use that then as a basis. Okay, I don't like this part, I don't like that part. But there's been this sort of thing, union, just come and talk to us. Like, you're not going to ask Republicans to talk about how to make the union with Britain better. You're not going to get unionists to talk about
it. It's kind of naive to expect members of the Orange Order to sit down and figure out how to become Irish.
You know, it's either naive or disingenuous. But, you know, if you want to be proactive about it, do something like write a constitution, put it on the table. What would a 32-county constitution look like?
I don't know whether they're talking about your attitude in United Ireland or about your attitude towards COVID, but somebody says Dan O'Brien has been a rock of sense throughout all of this. Not always right, but then again, only my wife is always right, which is someone who knows exactly what side their bread is buttered on. Gabby, about that, the 23% of people saying that they will be willing to rejoin the Commonwealth to help support United Ireland, 58% of people disagreeing. And it's the one thing, if you look across all these 10 questions, it's the one that gets rejected pretty much all across the board. Only 23% of Fianna Fáil, only 29% of Fine Gael voters said that they'd support it, and only a quarter of Sinn Féin voters. Now, maybe it's remarkable that even a quarter of Sinn Féin voters would agree to rejoin the Commonwealth. But do people maybe understand how meaningful, or rather how meaningless, rejoining the Commonwealth might be? And that's, you know, some people might propose it as being a fairly empty gesture to unionists to make sure they don't feel too abandoned, but people are making it out to be more than it is, maybe.
Sort of an olive branch to keep them happy.
Yeah.
I know that the Business Post also writing today that Frank Feehan is the only sort of the strongest voice in government that's been pushing for rejoining the Commonwealth. Mm. Look, like, there's a lot of issues that are involved in when we talk about United Ireland. You know, Sinn Féin pushing for a poll, and then, you know, Arlene Foster has come out and said this nonsense of a talk of a unity poll.
Yeah.
You know, completely dismissive in her remarks. So I think it's, and I do agree with Dan, like, the security issue, that's going to be a really big thing. I mean, you know, we have to be very, very careful how we approach the issue. You know, the idea has been mooted many, many times, and there are people that are in very strong support of it, but there's people that do not have time for the idea of a United Ireland at all, and they don't consider themselves to be Irish. They don't want to be Irish. They live in Ireland. They live in the Northern Ireland, but they consider themselves to be British. Like, how do we get those people around the table when they're not even willing to be in the room? I think that's going to be by far the biggest challenge.
Well, somebody, a Twitter user who calls himself DUP leader parody, which maybe sort of illustrates their outlook on things, but they say that it's not particularly indicative without putting forward what the new flag or anthem would be as a replacement. It's like saying that I'll swap you €20 for something that's in the mystery box. That maybe, Gabby, that maybe Dan's onto something, that you actually need to come together with the bolts, nuts and bolts, a brand new constitution already drafted, so that people would know what exactly is at stake before they start answering hypothetical questions like this.
Yeah, who is it up to draft that constitution? Would it be Sinn Féin?
I think anybody, any of the civil society groups that are interested, any political parties who feel that it is the priority issue, you could have numerous ones. And the more the merrier.
And you pick your favourite one, is it?
Yeah, you pick aspects. It opens a debate. It allows shows like this to have a chat. Mm. I like this aspect of this proposed constitution. Yeah. I don't like this aspect.
I've put it to Sinn Féin before that Sinn Féin are always calling for there to be some national conversation or some white paper about what a United Ireland would look like. And I've always said back to them, you guys are a more organised 32-county body than most, with maybe the exception of the GAA. Why don't you guys do it? And the response that I get back from Sinn Féin people when I say that to them is, oh, well, if we put forward a proposal, then it's just going to be lambasted as the Sinn Féin proposal, and we won't get any meaningful engagement. We can't put forward something and then expect unionists to be able to treat it in good faith, because we know that they'll just rubbish it as being Sinn Féin propaganda.
Okay, I don't get that. Actually, why would Sinn Féin then even produce a manifesto before an election? That doesn't make any sense. But as I say, look, different people can do it. But I would also say I disagree with the idea of the government here pushing some sort of proposal on the basis that we are in a very, very fragile situation. If a state starts using all its power to push something, then I think that could destabilize the North well, further. I think it's up for civil society, political parties.
So it's citizens' assembly sort of stuff.
Well,
because if the Irish government does it, then it looks like the Irish government being subversive towards the UK.
Exactly. So what I wouldn't, citizens' assemblies tend to be organized by governments. I would say that as has happened, you know, there are groups who are having meetings, having discussions about it. I think that's very healthy. But I think more detail from those organizations and groupings, and I think a draft constitution would be the perfect way to push, to tease out the issues and let people see exactly what is being proposed.
Gary, a texter says, as a step towards United Ireland, maybe the proposed new bank holiday should be the 12th of July.
I don't know about that.
No?
I don't know how much. I think we had the suggestion of the Thanksgiving bank holiday from certain quarters of Fine Gael. Yeah. That did not go down
very well.
Which then
got rebranded as a Black Friday bank holiday because it's always around Thanksgiving anyway.
I don't think there's much... much favour for that, but look, like, I suppose it's a topic that, again, we would be talking probably a lot more if it wasn't for a massive health crisis facing our country. Yeah. But you know, you look at Sinn Féin and they're saying, I suppose one of their, what is the party essentially about? It is about uniting Ireland, and we're looking at the polls today, like 33%, they're staying steady. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar told his Fine Gael parliamentary party meeting this week that he expects the next general election to be in 2024, which is the expectation currently in many political circles. Like, that is still a long time to go for a political party. Like, obviously for Sinn Féin, they need to hold on to that high support. But, like, you know, the guts of 2 years, that's still a long way to go. And I think that if we are to be seriously considering a United Ireland soon, like, Sinn Féin would have to be in government.
Worth asking Dan, says one texter, about the cost of a United Ireland, which is a fair point and the often one that gets brought forward, that no matter what sort of constitutional arrangements you propose in advance of the question, a lot of people are just uneasy about what it means for them and their pockets. We know that there is a significant subsidy, often not quite explicitly remunerated, that comes from Britain, that basically Northern Ireland can't sustain itself economically and that it needs help from the British Exchequer to do it. Whether you think it's possible that an all-Ireland economy could actually sustain that, or what's it going to mean for those in the Republic?
I think, one, it would cost. The idea that it's not going to cost is wrong. There's no pent-up. We're already in a single market. So there aren't... Some people who advocate for a United Ireland immediately say that it would bring an economic benefit. I don't see an economic benefit.
At all?
No, I do. We're already in the same market. There aren't sort of market barriers to take down between the North and the South that would generate pent-up growth. On the other hand, there will be some costs, but I also think it will be manageable economically. I don't, you know, Northern Ireland is
have
not
you ever
the most...
done any research to put an estimate on how much it might require there by way of sort of subsidy?
Different people have done very different, and because the amount the British Exchequer pays, there's a lack of clarity about the scale of the subsidy. No analysis, economic analysis, will be able to tell you exactly. There's too many. It's like forecasting economic growth next year. Nobody can do it perfectly, but I do think it will be manageable. But there would be a cost. And hence the reason that most of these polls ask people, would they accept higher taxes? Because I think higher taxes would be inevitable in at least in the short term, as in the case for, say, Germany was unified. There was a solidarity tax for a long time to pay for it.
I mentioned before the break something which is a fairly common thread, I think, across many of the papers today. But you've written about it, about the cost of living and what is or isn't being done to try and address it.
Yeah. So for the first time in many years, inflation is really rising. It's really affecting people, particularly with heating bills, energy bills. That's where it's really coming through. And there's a huge debate about what to do about that. America has very, very strong inflation. Europe less so. So usually central banks increase interest rates to dampen economies when they're running too hot, and that brings inflation down. Now, what's going to happen? Obviously, many people would be concerned if interest rates go up, because that means more for their mortgages and more for anything they've borrowed. I'm arguing today that I think the central bank, European Central Bank, has got it right, that in Europe's case, it's different in America, but in Europe's case, this is a transitory spike in inflation. Now, I know it's difficult, and I know it means bills are up, but that it is not, it doesn't mean we're going back to the 70s or 80s with very high inflation, and therefore, I don't think we're going to have an interest rate hike next year. So
I spoke to the governor of the central bank about this because they were publishing a report on Thursday, and I got to interview him for a couple of minutes, and I asked him about this, and he says that there are three major links to inflation being as high as it is right now. One, that the cost of living this time last year was reasonably lower and maybe even fallen, so the year-on-year increase gets bigger as a result. The second one is the increase in world energy prices, which he says is just down to the reopening of economies as a whole. And I can't remember exactly what his third one was now that I'm in a live microphone at the heat of the moment, but again, it was saying that it was
supply chains
is what it was. So that the knock-on of the pandemic and the blockage of the Suez Canal means that just global supply is slightly all over the place at the moment, all of which he said are reasonably short term. So I said, well, you know, people are going to be looking at higher energy prices this Christmas. They're going to be looking for somebody to do something. And he said, if we intervene now, it could do more harm than good. It could result in further problems down the line. And that's the last thing we want.
Yeah, and as I say, I think the officialdom has got this one right. I could be wrong. I wouldn't bet the house that we won't get runaway inflation. But certainly going through the numbers, that's the case. I think it's worth just saying that we did have a big fall in prices, not a big fall, a fall in prices after the pandemic hit. So prices, a basket of consumer goods and services actually fell in price. Now, as of March of this year, they were actually a basket of all of the consumer goods that we buy, housing, everything included, food, everything, was actually lower than in the summer of 2008.
Really?
So in the past 7 months, we've had 3% increase in the basket. Now, in terms of where we've been over the past 12 years, that is an extremely big increase in the price
level.
In
9 months, yeah.
In just 7 months, okay?
Oh, sorry,
so
yeah.
So that is a big increase. Hopefully that increase will taper off. And as I think, it will wane in the spring as energy prices fall out of the index, and we'll go back to a lower and more manageable rate of inflation without interest rate increases.
But when things are as they are, though, when you have people who are like really, really struggling with the price of you know, petrol and diesel, which I can't ever remember ever being as high as it is right now. You're talking about 170 in a lot of places for a litre of petrol. Okay, yes, central banks might see this as being a short-term thing, but ought there not to be some kind of transitory thing where at least the government decides to lay off excise for even a couple of months just to help people over the hump of
this? Well, page two, I've just my notes here. Page two on the Business Post, there is a discussion about a package of measures for home heating over the for the government to assist
people. Carbon tax
with.
Doesn't go up on that until May, I think, so
okay.
That at least helps
and
that.
And many countries across Europe have taken emergency governments, not central banks, governments to subsidize and to help people get through with higher energy bills during the winter. And I think there is a case for that, you know, because these have been very, very, very high, but transitory, short term, because the problem is likely to be transitory.
Yeah. But you don't think that there should be some governmental intervention at least in the short term? Because I've heard them say that they don't want to increase the fuel allowance because there's the risk then that you suddenly create a market for fuel which is more expensive and then you actually contribute to inflation further down the line. But you could just cut excise for like 3 months just to get people over the winter.
As I say, many governments have done it, and it's been discussed in page two of the Business Post about potential ideas. I certainly don't think it should be ruled out. In this case, it is causing genuine hardship for some people, and there is a case for some short-term government interaction to do. There is a case for it.
Gabby?
Can I talk about that genuine short-term hardship for people? So, interestingly, Sinn Féin actually came out with a survey this week. The social protection spokesperson, Claire Curran, she launched a survey on the cost of living. And they found that more than 3 in 4 people said that the rising cost of living is impacting negatively on their mental health. Over 98% of people think that the government is not doing enough to address the increases in the cost of living. And interestingly, one respondent said that she had high anxiety because she didn't know if she would be able to pay rent or electricity bills, and that her 10-year-old son can see that she's not okay. I mean, look, I think it's
grim.
It is grim. And I think, look, it's an online survey done by Sinn Féin, and obviously Sinn Féin are kind of using that against the government as in their political favour.
But the idea that a 10-year-old is able to spot a change in an adult's mood because they know they're certainly worried about the bank.
This is it. And like, we're hearing so much talk about rising costs of prices, and we're seeing it, as you're saying as well, at the petrol pump. If you're looking at electricity prices, we've heard that figure of €400, that would be an increase onto your bills. Like, that has spooked a lot of households around the country, and they're thinking, oh my god, will I actually be able to you know, make the ends meet this winter? And it's, you know, even if it is a short term blip, hopefully it is, but like, it does call for the government to, you know, to, I suppose, help out these people a little bit.
It is maybe linked to the whole question mark about the price of housing as well, which is another issue which again is mentioned in the Business Post. Killian Woods has found a survey commissioned, or a report commissioned by Dublin City Council, which finds that the cost of housing, at least in Dublin, is going to continue to rise at least until the year 2028. And you can understand then why people are suddenly worried about how much money they've got in their pockets.
Yeah, very grim findings there. So that median price would be €476,000 per
median
house.
Price. So it's not necessarily the average. It's not skewed by the cheapest or the most expensive. The middle of the road price 476,000 euro.
For a house in Dublin, yeah. It actually comes hand in hand with the central bank decision this week. You know, they launched their, I suppose, that report that you were mentioning earlier. They've given a green light to the housing minister, Dara O'Brien's controversial shared equity scheme, which many think, you know, the ESRI, many think tanks have warned that it will actually lead to an increase in house prices. And the central bank themselves have given that green light to the shared equity scheme for the commercial banks to participate in it. But they have also said it may lead to an increase in house prices. Mm. So we're having all of these warnings from quite literally everybody. And yet the government is still proceeding. Yes, house prices are going to increase. I think it's important to mention an opinion piece actually in the Irish Times by John McCartney last week of BNP Paribas, who said that, does the government actually want the house prices to fall? You know, the housing assistance payment, it's being wound down, but it was extended in the budget. Help to Buy is also being extended. You know, commentators have made arguments that those are two schemes that are leading to an increase in house prices. So, like, is any of this really a surprise to us if the government fundamentally doesn't want house prices to come down?
I'm going
to
ask Dan's opinion on that in 20 seconds, but just somebody has let me know that the chair of the UK Commons Northern Ireland Committee is actually on Sunday Politics on BBC Northern Ireland right now. And he says that they would actually expect the Dublin government to set out what a reunified Ireland would look like. They actually think the Irish state should draw up a constitution for what a united Ireland might look like, just to add to our earlier conversation. Dan, we've got about 60 seconds on that idea of whether the government actually would want house prices to fall, because it strikes me that if the middle of the road house in Dublin is going to be rising to 476,000 euro, that is just going to be at a level which is genuinely, whatever about inflation, just unaffordable for the vast majority of people.
To 60 seconds, Help to Buy, shared equity is madness. Government getting involved, the property market just boosts prices. It's done to show that they're doing something. It actually makes the problem worse. Help to Buy, shared equity
stimulates supply.
It's crazy stuff. Okay, let's also say a positive thing. Since 2018, the housing market has actually cooled in Ireland. Just before the pandemic, house price inflation had come down to 1% a year, and that shows that things are moving. Were moving into alignment before the pandemic hit. So I think there, and rents were coming down as well. Were below 4% just before the pandemic. Mm. Things have unfortunately shot up again in more recent months, part of this wider inflationary pattern. But let's just say that in the years up to the pandemic, the housing market was coming into alignment. Rents and price inflation were both falling sharply and were down to manageable levels.
And will that continue to happen then when things level off?
I would hope so, but we obviously built less in the pandemic, which is a problem with supply, and many people saved more money, so more money has been spent on housing issues. So there's a problem there.
Dan O'Brien, columnist with the Business Post and chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs, and Gabby Agatovitz-Gita, who's a political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Thank you both very much for joining us.